but the, present, you know, experimental limits. Okay, so we were talking about management regularization. Let me do that aside here. So we boiled down the problem to we wanted to evaluate integrals along the line of integral d4r of r squared divided by r squared m squared minus I epsilon squared. But we might well just as well look at this class of things. And so I did several steps. So I said that we were going to do width rotation. So we're going to go to from Minkowski to Euclidean signature by rotating the contour in the energy plane, and that took us to I and integral d4 Euclidean r squared Euclidean, because the signature was right, divided by r Euclidean squared plus m squared dv, as opposed to minus signs in there. And then we did the angular integral. The angular integral was omega for an n minus, we could have done the angular integral in four dimensions, which would be, give us the three volume of the three sphere, which is 2 pi squared, times the radial integral, which diverged at the ultraviolet end for the a's and b's that were interesting to us. And so the last thing was this observation that what we could do is, instead we could think, if we wanted to just regulate, we're at the level of now just trying to identify the divergence so we can talk about how we would subtract it or not. Well, first we have to just, you know, display it. So that's a question of regularization. And the story of regularization is, maybe later on I'll make this argument. The bottom line of regularization is that it's very similar to the story about the divergent series I was telling you before, that if you take something like this, you know, the q squared is appearing because of the m squared. We might as well just think of this thing as a function of m squared. The moral about regularizations is that imagine that you took the you did a series near m squared equals zero here. Then every time you differentiate it, so the way you do a series is that you differentiate this thing with respect to m squared and evaluate m squared equals zero first. Or maybe m squared equals some non-zero that's the arbitrary value. Every time you differentiate this thing with respect to m squared, you're going to get more r squared than in the denominator. And so the statement is that for any a and b, eventually there's a c for which dc I dm squared to the C is finite. So the integral you get is just going to converge. If we just, let's say we're sticking in four dimensions, but we can do the same thing. For any fixed A and B, if I differentiate this thing enough times, every time I differentiate, I bring in a new denominator, and eventually the denominator wins, and that's going to converge for large R. And so the statement then is that if I demand that my regularization scheme for this integral satisfies that that I'm allowed to differentiate inside the integral like I just did. So that if I give you the regularized, if I define this, this integral doesn't exist if it's diverging. But if I define it by modifying it by sticking in a cutoff or by doing this n dimension, I'm just giving you a parameter where if I take the parameter to some limit, I'm going to get this thing which is diverging. Whatever that definition is, if it has the property that if I differentiate this integral with respect to m squared, I can differentiate through the integration sign. So the convergence of this integral is good enough that I can do that. And if the answer is linear, so if I have sums of integrands, the integral of the sums of integrands is the sum of the regulated integrals, then you're guaranteed that the difference between any two answers that are for a regularized expression have to be differing in some polynomial in F squared, because I could always write this, you know, your favorite regularization will be my favorite regularization plus whatever the first few things. The fact that I've taken F derivatives means it's finite says that if I did a Taylor expansion, the first few terms will be diverging, but then eventually they start to converge. So let's say that, supposing it was true that the first derivative converged already, then that would mean that any two regularizations of I have to differ by something which is M squared independent. Because when I take the difference between your regularization and my regularization, they both satisfy that if I differentiate them, I get something finite. That means that the difference, the thing that wasn't finite had to be independent of M squared, because when I differentiate it, it's zero. And if it happens that the second derivative is the first one that's finite, that means that the difference between any two regularized answers is a constant plus M squared, with coefficients that are diverging. And so depending on how many derivatives you have to take to make it finite, it just shows you that the two regularized answers are going to differ by some polynomial, you know, A naught plus A1 M squared plus A2 M to the fourth. And how many of these A's will depend on what C was, is the bottom line. So that means that as long as you ask your regularization scheme to satisfy those two very, very mild properties that you can differentiate through the interval, that you can add things, then the same argument that Hardy made in that book that I told you about 100 years ago applies here. And that the only thing that depends on how you regulate is these coefficients here. And the bottom line of this renormalization program is going to be that these things that are diverging are exactly the things that you didn't know in the Lebrun anyway. And so that you had to fix those by comparing to some observable like the mass of the Z boson, or whatever your favorite observable was. In this case, it would be the electric charge, or actually, it would be related to the electric charge. But the thing is, you're in the comparison between the parameter and the Lagrangian, which wasn't known, and the physical observable, you have divergences. And in all the other observables that you're calculating as a function of those parameters, you have divergences. But once you express the observables in terms of the observable, in terms of which you fix the parameter, all the divergences are canceling out. And that's happening because the divergences are appearing in a very specific way as a function of momentum. They're appearing as polynomials of momentum up to some fixed order in a normalizable theory. And those polynomials correspond to the numbers of derivatives you already had in your action. And so if you imagine changing terms in your action, you get things with exactly the same momentum structure as you can have diverging here. That's kind of why it works. So I'll show you kind of how that works in this specific example. But you should keep in mind that when you first do this, it sounds really bizarre. You know, I use dimension regularization, someone else uses a cutoff, someone else uses something else. It sounds like you have to, it makes a difference, and it doesn't make a difference. Nothing depends on how you regulate things. The only person who will suffer from a bad choice of regularization is you, because it'll make your calculation hard. But if you calculate things properly, you're not finished until you've actually linked observables to observables. And so the renormalization program is, you have to replace the parameters in your, what we're talking about here is what's an observable in terms of the parameters in the action. The electric charge or the other things that were in the Lagrangian. You're not finished until you've eliminated those parameters in terms of other observables. And once you've related observables to observables, then everything is always the same. So you have to regulate and then renormalize. And once you finish, that's when you set something physical. It's only when you stop and you regulate and you haven't renormalized yet, or you renormalize without regulating, that you can make it look like things depend on what your regularization scheme is. So since it doesn't make a difference, use the most convenient one, and that's why people use dimensional regularization. It's by far the most convenient regularization scheme. It's easy to use, it keeps the symmetries you want manifest. But you have to do these integrals, and the last integral we wanted to do, I thought it was still a board here, but maybe not. I guess I wrote it up here again. So we have to do this integral. Let me just erase this slide. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to think of this in n dimensions. So we have I. So now the Anger part of the integral becomes the volume of an n minus 1 sphere, because the directions that are swept out by this radial vector sweep out that sphere. And then we're left with the integral from 0 to infinity dr of r to the n minus 1 plus 2a over r squared plus m squared. So if we can do that integral, then we're in fact city. And then the logic was that if the real part of n is sufficiently large and negative, these integrals converge. And then we'll define it for other n by analytic continuation. And that's different, what people are often tempted to say with dimensional representation is that we know what the answer is for all the integers, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, or something like that, or minus 5, minus 8. And you can't analytically continue from a point. You have to have a region in the complex plane from which to continue. And so there's a kind of an empty objection to dimensional regularization, which says that no matter what answer I give you, I can always add something like sine of pi n, which vanishes at every integer, but which differs throughout the complex plane. And that's a different regularization of this integral. And the argument I gave you just now shows you why that doesn't really make a difference. That'll all be something which you can do. You'll change what the regularized integrals are a little bit, but once you've gone to the normalized statements, it's all done. Because the things you're arguing about are all things that are canceling. So I'm not going to worry about that. I'm just going to evaluate this thing. It's a very simple integral to do. It's based on, you know, doing this integral is based on the, you know, this famous function, the beta function, which is, you know, m of x, m of y, divided by m of x plus y. And it has an integral representation, which is t to the x minus 1, 1 minus t to the y minus 1. I think that's right. That's actually not the one I wanted. Sorry. Let me give you a different integral representation. That's the standard one. The better one is t to the x minus 1, 1 plus t to the y plus 1, x plus y. So. So the, you know, the reason that this is a useful way of writing things is that all we'll do is we'll scale. How do we do this now? And then 1 minus t, that was the right limits. There's a change of variables from that one to this one, where it's like the kid, you map the interval from 0 to 1 to the interval from 0 to infinity. And I forgot exactly how you do that. But it's not a big deal. So that's a simple change of variable. But you kind of see that if you know this is true, then you know how to do this interval, because all we just do is we scale m squared at a bar, and we'll get a power of m squared, and we'll be left with an interval which is sent to this one, which we know is gamma function. So gamma functions, you know everything there is to know about them. So the bottom line is that I of m squared just becomes I times omega m minus 1. The m squared you can read off on dimensional grounds, right? If I scale m squared over r squared, then I'm going to get m to the m squared to the, what is that? N plus 2a. Minus 2b, 2. There's some dimensional ground that I have to be right. And all we have to work with now is this factor up front. That factor is gamma of the first power is 1, so that's, I've written this in a funny way, it's the problem. It's n plus 2a. Gamma of n minus m minus 1. So b minus n plus 1 minus 2a minus 1. That's the gamma of n to b. I'm just using that expression there for the remainder of the interval. So if you put all that together, then the bottom line is that so and now I'm going to put in what the omega is. So it's I to the n over 2 gamma of A 2 on your oh, there's a factor of 2 wrong everywhere because I'm reading it as a function of I'm reading the x and y from that expression, but that expression t is r squared, not r. So the n minus 1 plus 2a should have really been n minus 1 over 2 plus a. So it's 2 over 2 plus a. A is okay. N 2 minus a. So it should be better. Yeah, that's good.
Well, both integral ways, dt and that is dr, so it's r to the very much t, or is it much t?
Sorry?
Integral ways, dr there. There is dt, so r converting back to t, or is it r squared
back to t? That integral is correct as it stands. It's just that if you want to, what I'm doing, I'm lifting a formula from my notes here, but I'm lifting it by combining two formulas in my head. And the formula I'm combining is essentially the one on the right. And I was reading off the power, so I'm looking at a formula which has t to the m and 1 plus t to the n. I'm reading off what that is in the answer. And I'm reading off in my head what m and n are in terms of a and b. And the problem was that I'm reading the power of r here rather than r squared because I should be looking at that. Because down here I've got the power of r squared.
Yeah, but it's an integral.
There's factors of 2 going on with the thing I get right. So the formula I wrote down here was wrong because of the thing I'm telling you about here. But the change of variables that you have to go for r squared, the 2 there, is included because the well, actually, maybe not this line, but this line is not included. Because there's actually a 2 in here that's being canceled in the answer here. So that's why I didn't want to. Right. It's always a mistake to combine two lines in my head. But I'm glad you're catching on that. Oh, and I think that there's a power of n squared. Basically, this is the same thing that's appearing here minus that. Yes. So we're in business. If we want to know what happens at n goes to 4, this does something ordinary. It does something that becomes some power of n squared. You can do whatever dimensional analysis that you have to have there. The thing that's interesting here is these functions. So nothing happens here. The n over 2 becomes 2, and so gamma 2 is 1 factor of 1. B is going to be, we're interested really in B is equal to 2 in our real case, and we're interested in A is equal to either 0 or 1 practice. So B minus A is going to be 2 or 1. So this would be this is either minus 1 or minus 2, and this is plus 2. So we're going to get either 2 minus 2 is 0. That was the logarithmically divergent thing that we saw. Or we have 2 minus 1, which is 1, which is the thing which would be quadratically divergent if we done it in terms of the cutoff. But because this is this whole combination is becoming, is either 2 or 0. That means that this gamma function is being evaluated at 0 or minus 2. This one is being evaluated at something which is positive. N is n over 2 is 2, and then a is 0 or 1, so there's nothing on top there. The reason this is significant, this is being evaluated at 0 or minus 2, is that the gamma function, the only singularities it has are simple poles at the at all of the non-positive integers. So that means that z equals 0, minus 1, minus 2, minus 3. And so if we try to evaluate this expression at n equals 4, it blows up on us. And that's the reflection that the original integral did. You know, this is a better expression than the integral. The integral would have diverged if n was equal to 5 halves. But this doesn't. This is only diverging at specific integer values. And not only that, you can read off exactly how it diverges, because the gamma function is such a simple function. So, you know, the gamma function satisfies, remember, gamma 1 is 1. And it also satisfies that gamma 1 for z is equal to z, gamma z for all z. That was kind of expressing that it's like a factorial for, it's the generalization factorial to complex numbers. So these things together tell you how to figure out if you're near 0. So let's say we evaluated gamma of epsilon. So it's very close to 0. So epsilon is much less than 1. Think of that as being gamma of 1 plus minus 1 plus epsilon. I want to read this gamma 1 plus epsilon is epsilon gamma of epsilon. So that tells me that this thing, as epsilon goes to 0, is going to gamma of 1, which is just 1. And then if you do the Taylor expansion near 1, gamma of 1 plus epsilon, it's 1 plus the derivative of the gamma z, z equals 1, of epsilon, and so on. And this is a famous number. That's the somebody's constant. The Euler and Mascherelli constant. I want to make sure to find it properly. Work backwards from what it was. It's, I know the answer is going to be whatever epsilon. So this is minus gamma. The gamma is the that's the way I spelled it. It's going to be 0. 772157. So it's defined as an intermediate in a limiting way. But it's a known number anyway. And we typically are at the one level we're working now, it's enough to know the first term here. Because this with this tells us that the gamma of epsilon is just going to be, it's 1 over epsilon, gamma of 1 plus epsilon. That's just going to be, 1 over epsilon minus gamma plus quarter epsilon. And if you want to know what it is for minus 1, gamma of minus 1 plus epsilon, we can just use this again, right? Minus 1 plus epsilon times minus 1 plus epsilon is equal to gamma of, if I add 1 to this, I think gamma of epsilon, which is this. So it says that gamma of minus 1 plus epsilon is equal to 1 over minus 1 plus epsilon. Over epsilon. probably it's better to write this code. Right, so one of reps on that. And you can just do this iteratively. If you want to go to minus 2, minus 3, minus 4. And you see you're always going down only one pole because the previous pole is not diverging anymore when epsilon is equal to, this is diverging when z is close to, if I call this z, you know, when z is close to minus 1, that's this pole here, that's epsilon plus 0. But So except for everything I say, it's all true. So this is a true statement, and you're seeing that there's always a pole, one over epsilon. And it's just what epsilon equals zero means here is that this argument is going to minus one, as opposed to going to zero, which is what it does up here. But because we know this expansion, you know, we can expand everything as hard as epsilon again. This thing is giving us something order epsilon. If we expand the epsilon, we're just really getting a minus sign here. So what the upshot is that the pole term, the gamma of minus k plus epsilon, is going to be minus to the k for epsilon. And then there's a term which is going to be the next direction where you have to expand this thing out and you get an Euler match this contribution. And you expand this term out, and if you went to minus k, you'd have a lot of terms like this which you'd expand out. And keep the linear term and you get some coefficient which I don't care what it is. But it's something which is just easy to use. And Maple will do it for you in a blink of an eye. But the main message is it's a pole. It's a very worst case scenario, it's a pole. So it's sufficient when we're following how these things behave. We're interested in n near 4. And what we're going to have to do is not just evaluate this as n equals 4, because then that would diverge. What we have to do is take the limit as n goes to 4. And we're expecting that one piece of this thing is going to have a pole in that limit. And then there'll be a subdominant piece, which is this one, which will be finite. And that's the thing that, and then once we get to this, we can forget it, because that's something which as n goes to 4, it's going to go to 0. And so this is the divergent piece we're going to want to follow and see, watch it cancel and things. This is the finite residue that's going to survive that. And this is something which is never going to play any role if n goes to 4. You can see that if you're interested in field theory in higher dimensions, this generalizes completely trivially. It's just the limit you're taking is instead of being n equals 4, it'll be n equals 6 or 10 or whatever your favorite number is. And you're still picking off these poles. Because n is occurring negatively here, you're getting more and more poles. So that for large positive n's that are integers, you're picking up these poles no matter where you are for all the even n's. For odd n's, the n over 2 is always making this thing finite. And that's the statement that's a kind of famous statement that in dimensional regularization, at one of in odd dimensions of space-time, one of the integrals happens to be finite in dimensional regularization. And if you've been doing cutoffs, that's the statement that you typically get cutoffs squared everywhere. And if you get an odd part of a cutoff, you need a square root of that, which is quite good in a loop. And so it's not necessarily true that in a cutoff you don't get these contributions, but it's very simple dimensional regularization. Let me now just cut the chase to go back to what the answer was. That was kind of a whole bunch of technology, and we just want to apply it to the 3D case.
Do you get divergence with the dark components?
Sorry?
Do you ever get divergence with the dark
components? Well, ultraviolet divergences. I want to say that you do get infrared divergences, not from loops. The classic example would be if you have some process and then you radiate a massive particle from an external line. What happens there is that you have if this momentum is k, that momentum is l, and that has to be k plus l. And so if you had something like this propagator would be 1 over k plus l squared with m squared and minus my epsilon. Then you have some photon factors of some amplitude to do with these lines and the rest of the graph. And then there's a deep decay. So you, what you want to do is you'd be spurring that, and you do have a deep free allergies. The thing is that if you look at this, if I've done this right, over, you need to be all over L naught, right? Because the rise of branch rate is that. So this thing is k squared plus L squared plus m squared. Let me write it this way. It's k squared plus m squared plus L squared plus 2 k dot L minus I epsilon. But this line is on the shell, on mass shell, so it satisfies the k squared plus m squared equals 0. And this line is on mass shell, and it's massless, so it's L squared 0. So those are all 0. It's together 0. So this whole thing is actually linear from the denominator goes linearly with L as L goes to 0. And you square it to get 1 over L squared. So now you get 1 over L cubed d3L. The whole thing goes logarithmically, diverges logarithmically as L goes to 0. That's the famous problem in four dimensions. So that relied on being four dimensions that three is key. But if I had 5 there, it wouldn't have diverged. If I had 2 there, it would have been worse. So the lower your dimension you're in, the more infrared diverges are a problem. And four dimensions is kind of a borderline for this kind of thing. So that's an example of how you get infrared diverges. But for ultraviolet diverges, I think not, because all the integrals, and there's a reason for it, at least for S matrix elements, because the integral that you're doing is always, the only integrals you do that are not loop integrals are in phase space integrals in S matrix, and these things are always restricted by the energy momentum conservation. You know, some of the energy is zero. And so the thing is that that's something which, if you try to make some of these elements large, you eventually will violate this conservation energy story, because you've got some fixed energy going in. That this is assuming that you've got a relativistic dispersion relation where the energy is the square root of momentum squared plus m squared. So as L moves in, energy is growing monotonically with L. And it becomes, goes to infinity as L goes to infinity. And so this thing essentially cuts off your integrals, given that you start off with a finite initial energy. So that these integrals that are going to be giving you trouble, it'll only be either at L equals 0 or at some place where there's a funny kinematic region where, for some reason, an amplitude went to 0. Remember, I told you that if you had something like that, you could imagine sometimes you can force this denominator to go through 0 depending on how you the angles are, the angles in scattering. When we talked about scattering, I mentioned that. So if your amplitude has got a funny kinematic region where it's going up, it could be a problem for you. And zero could be a problem for you if you have massive particles, but the ultraviolet end is not the problem for the phase space. So let me just write down what the answer is here. So what I'm going to do is I'm just applying those things, and it's just algebra now. We have this expression. Well, there's one more thing I guess you have to see. We have to do this trace, but we're doing this trace, we have to be careful now. We're doing it in n dimensions, right? No, not four dimensions. And I told you how to do this in four dimensions before. But n dimensions, we've got to be more careful. So how do you do the trace? You have to do the trace of gamma mu and gamma nu. We have to do the trace of 4 gamma matrices. And again, Lorentz invariance tells us that the answer has to be something constant times a to mu nu. Or another way of deriving that would be you could write gamma mu, the trace of gamma mu, gamma nu. This thing is symmetric. If I did it's a cyclic. It's a trace of cyclic, so I can change the order of the gamma matrices. So I can write it as 1/2 trace of the anti-commutator of gamma mu, gamma nu. And this is just 2 times a to mu nu. So you can use the properties of the gamma matrices to derive this directly, but it's also true that the Lorentz invariance says there's nothing else to be. And the coefficient here is, you can tell from this, it's just the trace of 1. And that's just telling you how big is the spinner in 4 dimensions. And so we were always getting 4 in 4 dimensions because all the spinners were 2 components. We have 2 left-handed, 2 right-handed components. But if you're in n dimensions, a spinner, want to say the answer, and then I'm not thinking about it. There's a good reason for it. It's not coming to me right away, and I don't want to do a group theory argument. But spinner in n dimensions is 2 to the n over 2 has that many components. So, for example, when n is equal to 4, this would have been 2 to the 2, which is 4 components. And what happens is that every even dimension, you have left and right hand spinner, basically. And so, I'm just going to take my word for that. Yeah. It's not hitting me as a good. So let's call this, we call it D or something. In fact, I call it something else. Let's call it really D. And so what this is telling you is the size of the representation of these gamma matrices. And there's a better argument than I'm giving you here, and it's just I'm losing it. So anyway, depth chart would be that this would be 2 to the n over 2, because that the trace is the same number of spinners. And the same argument that this thing, you remember, had to be something times, it's basically the trace of 1 times a mu nu, eta lambda rho, and well, this is just any standard pairs of interchanges, so it's minus eta a lambda eta nu rho plus eta nu rho eta nu lambda. That's a consequence of Lorentz invariance and the symmetries that you get from the Dirac algebra and the cyclicity of the trace. And the coefficient we chose is 4 before, but that comes to us as being a trace of 1 in the same way, same kind of argument as we're doing here. And so, again, in n dimensions, we want to promote that 4 to a 2 to the n over 2. So, keeping that in mind, we can go through the trace just like we did before. You have to be sure that the traces of these things are going to go through exactly like they did before, but now factors of 4 in front of everything are factors of 2 to the n over 2. So it's not such a big deal, but it's you can do it. So I'm going to leave that there, because that's not the problem. So the bottom line is, if you let me just skip through the next steps, let's write the answer. So if you do the trace, this becomes minus 9 e squared. Now this I is going to hit this I over here. So I'm going to stop writing it. Right, the one that came from the Euclidean space. So I'm going to e squared, and all the x, take the 1. Oh, there's one more thing I got to tell you. So let me write the answer, and then I'll tell you how I like it. So, and right now, in intermediate steps, you can see what it is. I'm actually going to write 2 pi to the n here, although it's, again, that's a convention. So I'm just basically telling you what the trace is here. So it's n mu nu divided by e squared. N mu nu, once you do the trace in the dimensions, is 2 to the n over 2, 1 minus p over n. P is now q. Yeah. So you can kind of see where the terms came from, right? There's a, we got terms, the things involving the x's here are, things involving QBU's canoes. Well, let me not say that because I don't think it's really. These things are coming from this term here, which is the only place we're getting dangling indices in the Q's. What's confusing me is that the X's here are looking different. Because there's a keep up the next line, and if that was then 1 minus x, there comes x. So this should have been an x minus 1. I just didn't carry it down properly. So we've done the trace. We just have to do the integral now, and it just comes down to integrals along the lines of what we've been looking at. P has become, I'm reading it in a different location. This is R. That's R squared. That's a Q. That's a Q. So I got confused with my notes here. When I'm calling P, my notes is what was R before here. So this is an R squared, that's an R squared. So now the integrals, this is an integral that we know how to do over there. The R squared divided by the denominator squared. And this is the no R squared in it. So if you plug those in, it all becomes, there's a grouping of terms which is very nice. So you're going to say, what the hell is mu? So there's one thing I forgot to say in the introduction. If I didn't have, supposing the way I wrote this answer, the first thing you need to do with anything is check its dimensions, right? If you make a mistake, it doesn't make dimensional sense. And the thing is that, so this has got dimensions of mass squared, because it's quadratic in momenta. This has got dimensions of 1 over mass to the fourth. When this was d4, R, it was mass to the fourth, and so this whole thing was dimensionless, and that's the right answer for pi mu, because we're adding it to 1, right? It doesn't look different down here, but this has to be dimensionless. The problem is, once you write this as being dnr, the dimensions aren't working anymore, because this is now mass to the n, whereas this thing is 1 over mass to the fourth. So there's a dimensionally wrong thing here, and so if you think about what happened to the dimensions, implicitly, we're thinking e is dimensionless, and if you go to n dimensions, that's no longer true. So we have to think a little bit more carefully about the dimensions of E. Remember, the way you decide dimensions of coupling is we take the interaction was the action was the integral d for x of the Lagrangian, and the Lagrangian in this case was E psi bar, gamma mu, psi, a mu, yeah, times a charge. And we knew the dimensions of the field, and the argument was that these are dimensions, mass of the 3/2, that's the dimension of the mass, so that means these combined give us mass of the fourth, so that's why E is dimensionless. E is dimensionless because this is mass of the fourth, so the Lagrangian has to be mass of the fourth because we're integrating it d4x to get the action, and the action has dimensions of h bar, which is dimensionless. So you see that for n dimensions, it's two things change. One is This is now mass to the n, not 4. So the target is different. But it's also to the dimension of the field that's going to change. Because how do we know the dimension of a field? We canonically normalize it. We looked at the kinetic term. We had it have a standard form with just a numerical coefficient. So we had kinetic term was integral d4x. For fermion, it was psi bar d slash psi. And that's going to be true, you know, minus 1/2. In n dimensions, it can still be true. And for the gauge field, we had minus 1/4 f mu. And so we have to rethink what the field dimension is now, because the action, again, is dimensionless. So this is supposed to be dimensions of mass to the n. The derivative is still mass, because it's 1 over length. So that means that the dimension of psi is now, you know, it's n minus 1 over 2, because it's fluid, right? So it's the mass to the n minus 1 over 2. So when n equals 4, this would be 3/2, and it would be 4. And for the gauge field, we've got derivative, gauge field. So there's two derivatives. So we have to take mass to the n minus 2 once you subtract the derivatives, and half of what's left would be the gauge field dimension. So the dimension of a mu in n dimensions is going to be mass to the n minus 2. And again, if n is 4, this becomes 2 over 2 is 1, which is what we're used to. So with this, this means that psi bar gamma mu psi a goes like mass to the n minus 1 for the two fermions plus n over 2 minus 1 for the boson. So that's mass to the n plus n over 2 is 3 n over 2 minus 2. So I pull up the over 2, this is 3 n, oh, no, it's whatever that. Let's just press on. Does that look right to you? 3 over 2 minus 2. So the coupling coefficient E, the dimension of E, should be its mass to the n, the whole Lagrangian, minus the distance, minus 3 n over 2 minus 2. So that's mass to the. If n were 4 here, we would have had 6 minus 2 is 4, and that would be right. So this is something okay. So we get n minus 3 n over 2 is minus n over 2 plus 2. So that's mass to the 4 minus n over 2. That's right. So if n is 4, it's dimensionless, but otherwise not. So the thing is that what's making the dimensions work out there is the fact of e squared, because e squared is dimensions of 1 over mass to the n minus 4, which is exactly canceling the dimension you have for the interval there. So the dimensions work, it's just that we're thinking of e squared being dimensionless. So it's and it's hard to stop your mind thinking of e squared as dimensionless. So what it's convenient to do is to take e and scale up an explicit factor of define e to be dimensionless e, you know, e naught if you like, times some arbitrary mass scale to the 4 minus n over 2. And if we did that, then up here we would have had e squared times mu 4 minus n. And that's the final expression. And now the dimensions are kind of just explicit. The mu here is canceling the dimension of that. And you can think of e naught as being dimensionless, no matter what that number of space time dimensions are.
So what would be the scale factor in a larger dimension? Like, how would you choose mu? Yeah, basically. Like what sort of physics does it have to do with in larger dimensions?
Maybe you're physically in the higher dimension, you really are living in the higher dimensions, and it's not just a dimensional continuation from 4.
Yeah.
Well, then it's just really just physically true that these couplings have dimensions. So it's like the Fermi constant has dimensions. So you'll find that they set a scale. So if you're in 3 dimensions, say, rather than 4, then E in that case should have been a mass. Did I get that right? So this is 3, oops, this is square root of mass. Yeah, E squared is a mass, right? Alpha is a mass. So if you actually, one of the mass scales of three-dimensional QED is set by coupling constant. And it's kind of funny when you first see it, because we're not thinking coupling constant has dimensions, but it does. So you can really see that there's one way to see that is that FPU, you know, you can write that one resource part, but there's another term you write down in the free dimension, which is epsilon mu lambda a mu f mu lambda, which is Bayesian variant 2. And the relative size, so these are both quadratic mass, and they essentially give it a mass. They give the gauge field a mass, and the mass is proportional to e squared. In fact, if you factor out one of e squared, then the thing with fewest derivatives has e squared in front of it. That's what gives you the difference. So the mass is actually e squared. So it's just that the physics of how an electron behaves in higher dimensions and lower dimensions is different because e has the higher dimensions.
So why would we need to rescale this?
You don't, it's just convenience. It's just because, you know, normally when you're looking for dimensions, you're trained to think that E is dimensionless. And so I just define it so it is dimensionless. So it's completely convenient. And it's useful to be able to follow this. One thing you want to be able to follow is this scale mu. You know, you want to follow how it appears in the answer, because it's going to appear in the answer, because it looks like it's not going to appear in the answer when mu goes to n goes to 4. But remember, we're going to multiply the same time for something with a pole, which has got 1 over n minus 4 in it. So
but if you don't risk it, just keep the e squared there, so the answer is there should be no
mu. Yeah, but it makes you could do that, and it just makes it more cumbersome to understand the dimensions of your answer. Because you're going to see when I go explicitly to n goes
to 4. Because I that u sim goes to 0 and see that. All I'm saying, if you don't rescale it, then since this parameter doesn't show up, I don't know if the renormalization group is generated, how do you interpret that? If you just
you're skipping ahead of me, because you're thinking that mu is going to be the thing of the normalization group.
Yeah.
And it's true that it's convenient to set the normalization group up so that mu is that, but you don't need, if you didn't scale it out and you kept the way you want to do it, you could still define a normalization group, and because the scale of a normalization group is something else. It's in principle, it's a scale which you're doing some physical thing. Where you're doing the normalization is what the scale is. And so you're not required to do this. It's just very convenient to do this. What board can I lose here? Anyway, I'm going to write the answer down because I'm running out of time here. So you can do the integral, and you're left with I mean, is p naught squared mu to the 4 minus n 2 pi 2 1 dx 2 1 effect e q squared x plus x plus m squared to its power that came from times what we call f we knew. Net mu is given by x minus x 2 q mu q So it's a dog breakfast, basically, right? It's a big mess. But what you can do is you can simplify some things. You can, these gamma matrices satisfy this identity that gamma 1 plus x is 1 plus z is z plus z. So it allows you to simplify, you know, this over this is going to be simple because 1 plus n over 2 is really n over 2 times that. So the gammas are going to cancel. So you can group things together. And the bottom line is that once you do the grouping, this is a very nice simple form. It's becomes 2x minus x. And that's a form you can know and love because this has the property that q mu on pi mu is 0. Right? Because the q mu and this would be q squared times q mu, and then this you're going to get q mu, q squared is a sine, and then cancel. And at no step along the way was it clear that was going to happen until you get to this last part. But this is something which has to be true from gauge invariance. That's the statement that if you you know, what am I going to do with this amplitude? I'm going to take it and I'm going to fold it with the. If I were to change a gauge, you know, what happens is that this pi mu appears. Remember, it appeared in something like this. So we had a propagator here, a to mu, you know, mu alpha over q squared, let's say. We had pi, alpha, beta, and we had eta, beta, nu over q squared. But this expression for the propagator was done in a specific gauge. If I'd done it in a more general gauge, more generally what you'll get there is, for the propagator, is you'd get eta mu alpha plus some coefficient, q alpha, q nu over q squared, divided by some denominator, so q squared alpha epsilon. So in generic gauges, what happens is you change the coefficient of this q alpha q nu term, and I've just chosen a gauge where that happens. So the Feynman gauge is the one that's very simple where you just don't have that term at all. But if you do have a different gauge, you have these extra terms. And the reason the answer doesn't care on what gauge you're doing it in is that when I contract these other terms with pi here, the q contracted with pi satisfies this identity that you can always get to zero. And that's ultimately coming from the gauge invariance of the problem. And so if this had not worked out this way, it would have been a problem. It would have been a sign that the answer we're copying was gauge effect. And so it's and if you had, in particular, if you'd gone back and said, if we'd done this with a cutoff, what would we have expected to find? You know, the term, this term here, the powers of this is the thing that was m squared in our dimensional expression over here. The capital M squared was this, it was just little m squared plus x1 minus x2 squared. And so, remember, we had a logarithmically divergent term, and we had a linearly and a quadratically divergent term, and we talked in terms of cutoff. You can track those through to here. Those are the ones that just come with different powers of this factor here. So the one, this term, without this factor, we just multiply this. When n goes to 4, this goes to 0, that's the logarithmically divergent term. And this factor is the quadratically divergent term. And this combination, you know, these two terms separately don't have the property that q mu on them is 0. So if you had a cutoff, what you would have found is that the quadratically divergent part was not gauge invariant, and the logarithmically divergent part was not gauge invariant. But if you were careful and you kept track of everything right through the end, you'd find that things could be grouped into a gauge invariant way, and the cutoff dependence, once you remove the cutoff dependence by expressing things in terms of physical things, you would have gotten something like this. But at no step along the way would it have looked like important contributions to a gauge invariant. So you would have been naively tempted to think, well, if I follow on, if I focus on the quadratically divergent piece, it's the thing that should be dominating, and it'll be gauge invariant by itself, and that wouldn't have been true. So that's kind of one of the nice things with dimensional regularization, is that it grouped things in a way which you wouldn't be grouping them. The dimensions here are being made up by this thing rather than by cutoff, because in dimensional regularization, you didn't introduce a dimensionful coupling, or a dimensionful cutoff. The only thing you've introduced with dimensions is this thing, and when 4 goes to n, this thing can only enter logarithmically because, you know, mu to the 4 minus n, if I think of that as mu to the epsilon, then you know, if that's really e to the epsilon log mu, and so that's just 1 plus epsilon log mu, 1 and a half epsilon squared log squared mu, so on. So I'm always getting logarithms of mu when I expand near n equals 4, this factor here. So I'm never going to get powers of mu to make dimensions up. So all the dimensions have to come from scales that were already in my problem, and that's one of the nice things with dimensional regularization, is that it forces all the scales to come from what's in your theory already, and the cutoff isn't coming in there as a fake scale in the answer. And the particular gauge invariance that plays a role in the gauge invariance, which is crucial. So what about normalization? Just cut to the final chase here. The bottom line is we've got a divergent part. So we can write this thing as being a, we can write this as being a pole part, you know, infinitely pi infinity mu nu plus pi finite mu nu. And the infinite part is just what I mean to do is you just take this thing and the Taylor expand near n equals 0, or do the Lorentz expansion, and then keep the piece which is proportional to 1 over n minus 4. And this is the piece which is finite because n goes to 4. And then we just drop all the things that are going to 0 as n goes to 4. And we have to deal with what are we supposed to do with that thing? And what can we possibly absorb it into? And let me just tell you what the answer is. What were the parameters we had in the original Lagrange? In particular, we're looking at a case which is what we're doing is we're modifying. You know, in our graph, we took the photon propagator and we changed it. So we're modifying how the photon propagates. So we should think about how photons behave in our Lagrange. And remember, they basically the propagation of the photon came from Maxwell's term. It looks like there's no parameters in there, right? It's we just got numbers here. But we've got numbers here because we've actually, originally when we used Lagrangian, we had a number here, but we scaled it out of the Lagrangian by the defining it into the field. And so we normalized A. A mu canonically. Set C equals 1. What happens, essentially what's happening here with this divergent part is that the quantum corrections are giving you new contributions to the axle which have the same form. So if you had one here before, now if you calculate C is really 1 plus you know, alpha times the coefficient, which is actually diverging as n goes to 4. And so if you have canonically normalized your Lagrangian classically, you have to renormalize your fields to make it canonical again once you've done the quantum corrections. So that's where the word renormalization comes from. So what we should do is we should think of, we start off with a Lagrangian like this, but the field we started off with wasn't really, it was classically normalized, canonically normalized, but it wasn't exactly, didn't remain canonically normalized once we include quantum corrections. So we should write A mu as being, or normalized in A mu, which really is at the quantum level canonically normalized, times some factor, which is conventionally Z to the 1. And we should think of Z being something which is 1 classically, but it has corrections at the quantum level. You know, some coefficient C times C1 times alpha, C2 times alpha squared, and so on. And if we're working the lowest order perturbation theory, we can forget all this stuff. And putting this into here, you know, we're going to get that this is minus 1/4 Z 3 times F normalized. And I can think of this perturbatively. If I'm thinking of things, you know, what I've done is we visit our unperturbed Lagrangian. We've now actually put it in an interaction here because we've got the Z3 is different from 1 by things that are of order alpha. So we can think of this as being minus 1/4, you know, normalized mu, plus an interaction term which is minus 1/4 C1 alpha, and we should, since this is order alpha, we should not put it in the unperturbed Lagrangian, we should put it in the perturbed Lagrangian. So if you stick this into element. So we're effectively introducing a new vertex, but it has two fields in that vertex. So it's like a vertex which is a, you know, has two external lines on it, and it doesn't have three or more external lines, which is what we've been thinking about till now. But its coefficient is something which is explicitly of order alpha, so it's something which is perturbatively small. And so that means that we should, if we've traced through the Feynman rules, in addition to these graphs, we should have also had this graph. Because that graph appears at the same order as this graph. If this is order alpha, and this coefficient was order alpha, the real answer is the sum of these things. And so it's going to involve this plus, basically, that coefficient C over there, up to some numerical constant, times Q squared, or Q mu, Q nu minus Q squared eta mu, that's what happens. if you, this combination of cubes is what you would have gotten if you wrote this combination of fields and the derivatives in momentum space, remember, because there's a derivative that's it's a d mu a nu minus d nu a mu times, same thing with the other field. This combination of the derivatives contracted in different ways is what gives you this combination q squared a to the nu minus q mu to q nu. And so the statement is that to make this thing canonically normalized, what we have to do is choose. To canonically normalize this field is the same thing as asking for the propagator to have the unit residue. It has a the propagator we've had. That's probably not a useful way to say it. You know, we're free to choose this thing. One way of choosing it would be to make the to canonically normalize the field F, but then you'd have to ask, what does it mean to canonically normalize the field F? What's the analog of the action in which we want to write everything? And there's a way of making this precise. There's a sense of it. There is an action that you can write down at the quantum level in terms of which you could ask, what's the kinetic term and is it canonically normalized? And that would involve a specific choice for C. And if you worked out what sort of choice was that canonically normalized everything, you'd see that the constant here has to be chosen to cancel this full part of pi, leaving you a finite term. Another way of saying that same normalization condition would be if you calculate the propagator, so if you calculate the time ordered product a mu and a nu affects y, it's always true that the propagator, if you Fourier transform it, you go to the momentum phase, you have e to the I, so basically we do x to 0, e to the I px integral d 4x. This thing in the momentum phase, you know, in perturbation theory, it had a piece which went like 1 over p squared plus, in this case there's no momentum squared, it's p squared minus I epsilon for massless particles. As an exact statement, if you just take the full field, it's always true that whatever this thing is a function of momentum, but it always has a pole where the particle at the particle mass shell. That's a general statement, but it doesn't necessarily always have a unit residue there. So if you write this thing as this is some function of if this propagator it has indices mu and nu, it always on the grounds of gauge invariance is proportional to p squared a to mu nu minus p nu times some function pi of p squared. And this pi of p squared is always near p squared equals 0, it always has the form of some number divided by p squared plus things that are finite as p squared equals 0. It's an exact statement that propagators have a residue, have a pole on the mass shell of the particle involved. And that's really the statement that I want to write here. That's the statement that we've already alluded to it before, but you know, when we talked about e plus e minus goes to z, goes to e plus e minus or some fermions, we thought about the virtual process, when you separate these things a long, long, long away from each other, eventually that was supposed to turn into the separate process of producing a z and the z decaying. If you chase that through, that statement relies on the fact that the propagator here has a pole, and that the residue of that pole is 1. If the residue of that pole wasn't 1, then if you calculate the process of a virtual particle, and you compare it to what you would have expected if you factorized things, you wouldn't get to get the, they wouldn't agree. The whole statement that things factorize properly is a consequence of the statement that the propagator, in terms of the physical field, has a pole at the mass shell with residue 1. And if we just calculated using this calculation, for what this correlation function would have been, we would have found that this z that I'm talking about would have been the residue of the pole, and it was not 1. And so another way of phrasing the choice we're making here is that this constant c that we've stuck in as an interaction is being chosen to make this residue 1, because that's something which you really would demand in a physical field in order to have the long distance behavior of the amplitudes behave properly. So the bottom line, though, is that there's two messages here. One is, you have to express the things in your ground in terms of physical things. And until now, you probably were thinking about coupling constants and masses as being the things you had to express that way. And that's true, you do have to express the masses and coupling constants in terms of physical measured things to figure out the numerical values. And that expression will involve divergences. But those divergences will cancel in the other expressions for other observables in terms of those same parameters. So that the observables in terms of observables is a finite expression. But you might not have bargained on the fact that there's actually hidden parameters in Lagrangian to do with the normalization choice of the field. Because we've been setting constants equal to 1 in our action when we wrote down the canonical form, and that was a choice of the field variables, and that choice need not have been preserved by the quantum correction, so you have to go back and redo it again. And I'm being vague as to how you precisely do this canonical normalization. But I can give you more information, but I can tell you where to read about it before. But the statement is that that's really one more parameter that you weren't really perhaps counting when you counted things in the Lagrangian, which you should count at the quantum level, because the choice you made need not have been preserved by the quantum corrections you're calculating now. So you have to go back and reset things to 1. If you made a choice, you have to remake that choice, because you only did it really at the classical level when we first did it. I was hoping to get to the running of the couplings. Maybe I can start that next time. We're almost there. Maybe I'll do that next time. That's something which I think you should probably see. You probably want to see it from me in a couple of things. Since you've got this far, you're almost. So far, it's all about graphs, but you haven't done any physics of the graph yet. It's also true, and you should. Where did you read this? In Weinberg's book, he actually does that expression for pi mu nu, the final one we got. There's a lot of physics in it, this one here, for the finite part. If you actually write down what this integral over x is, you can write it in position space, and it's describing the polar. People always talk that if you have a charge, then the virtual positron electron screen charges. You can actually make a very precise statement as to what the charge distribution is around a given charge using this if you go to position space. And Weinberg's book has a very nice description of that as to what the physical polarization, it really is behaving like electromagnetism when you relate D to E with a dielectric function. This function is very much like what we've got here for pi. And it's describing a distortion of the vacuum is responding to charges in such a way as to screen them partially. And that's physically what's going on with the normalization of the charges. That I'll talk about. So, I'm not going to actually do this, the whole Weinberg thing, because it's basically really beautiful, but it doesn't plug into anything useful that I'm going to say later on. But you should really read it, because it's one of the only places I've ever seen that written. You always hear the words about screening, but it's really, you already have all the information here to extract. What he essentially does is he calculates what charge distribution would give you this electric field that you're getting from this, and then although this is hard to integrate, the charge distribution that gives rise to this, you can explicitly do the integrals over momentum to write in position space, and it's a very, very clean function. Any questions about
that? So I guess you're going to do running things that have to do with this new term you put in the function?
It's related to it, because once you scale this, then at first I was not related to it, but the thing is that we also define the charge to be the coefficient of this, mu, a mu. But if I start rescaling this, then I'm going to have a factor of 3 to 1 half here. And if I do the same thing with the fermions, if their kinetic term changed, and I canonically normalize them, then I'm going to get factors of, say, Z2, or Z1, I think it's called, for the fermions, because I have 2 of them. And so that the scaling of the field of the kinetic term is actually also going to affect what you think the charge is. And it turns out there's an identity which says that the only thing that's important for E is actually Z3. And then more or less what's going on is the gauge invariant says that the derivative has to come together with E times E mu all the time for gauge invariant. So if I scale in the quantum electrodynamics, you define that we're normalized E to be some normalized thing times Z1, I guess it is. Something that's Z1. And Z2 is probably for the fermion, you say, is a renormalized one. Besides, it's not renormalized on Z2 to 1/2. And the electromagnetic one is this one. And then, so you, in principle, would have Z1 to the 1/2, Z2 to the 3, even normalized, size like A. Because you get this from rescaling those, you get this from rescaling that, and you get this because this could be changed too. But there's an identity in quantum electrodynamics which says that It says that E and A always appear together. So that says that if I write this in terms of E were normalized and A were normalized, they have to also appear only like that. So that means that the scaling I do in E cancels the scaling I do in A. So it says that Z3 and Z1 are clear. And so if I want to know, if I want to know how the charge is changing, it's sufficient to know how E is changing. So the calculation we just did is actually a function of charge.
And you mentioned that at the beginning of the course, when we were doing renormalizable Lagrangians, you enforced us to say that our couplings have to be, cannot be inverse powers in algebraic order.
Yeah.
That does not seem obvious in all this.
That's because, the magic part, you haven't seen yet. Because the thing is that every possible, so now you imagine calculating 15 billion electrons and photons. And the statement is going to have to be that I can, no matter what graph I do, no matter how many external lines I have, I'm going to be able to, and how many loops I have, all the derivatives I can get, I'm going to be able to always reabsorb into the same constants. It's always going to be one for E, one for psi, one for A, one for the mass of the electron, and that's it. Those four constants have to do everything.
Okay. So this will be seen when we do the running of things next time? Or?
No, it's something it's in Weinberg's book, in any renormalization book thing. The bottom line of the argument is that if you look at all these graphs and you ask how are they diverging, you just kind of look, write them as, collect all the integral V4Ps, the propagators, and just look at the large, you're looking at the large P limit to see how things diverge. So it's just propagators 1 over P squared and the vertices have no momentum in them at all. And you ask for a generic graph, how is this thing diverging? So it's going to be, and in the same way I did over there, you're counting the number of P's in the numerator minus the number of P's in the denominator, basically. And if you call that, that's called the superficial degree of divergence. It would be four times the number of integrals you do, which is one for every loop, and there's plus whatever was in your numerator, minus whatever's in your denominator. Is for that graph, that's the superficial degree of divergence. And so the statement is that you're only getting divergences for a very, and it is a function of the number of external lines you have about each kind. And then the statement is that this thing is only zero or positive, which would mean diverging, if you have two electromagnetic external lines and nothing else, or one electromagnetic and two fermionic external lines. And it's basically the things you would have had, the things you're always going to ask for the divergence to be canceled by some thing in the Lagrangian all the time. And you've got a limited number of counterterms. You've got something which is a propagator for the photon. The counterterm for the kinetic term for psi is something which is like a correction for the propagation of the fermion. And a correction to this is like a counterterm which has the same kind of structure as the one you start off with, the basic interaction. And a correction to the mass term for electrons is also this form. So if this is only going to work, you're only going to be able to absorb these divergences into these kinds of things if these divergences are only there if you have graphs of the form, electron or photon, or electron, something happens to photon, but nothing else. If you had a graph like this, which was diverging, then you're fucked because there's no counterterm you can write down in your Lagrangian which can absorb that divergence because nothing has two photons and two electrons in it. And that's the state of renormalizability.
So it's not so much the couplings, it's just the actual fields involved, and the couplings just happen to be a good way of bookkeeping? Or
if you were happy to make up a new interaction for every divergence, you'd have to add something which was like a nu, psi bar, gamma mu, gamma nu, or something, or maybe nu, psi. If you were prepared to write any interaction you like, then to absorb the divergences you're going to get, then you can always find a counterterm. But that means that as you get more and more complicated external lines, you're typically going to have more and more complicated kinds of interactions in your Lagrangian that you're saying have to be there, which you then have to go back and put through the final rules again. So the statement, you can get it all into some fixed number of parameters that we're already in the Lagrangian is a renormalizable statement. And the reason that the dimensionful coupling screws you is easy to see, because if you start putting in coupling constants which are 1 over m squared, so let's say, if I put it in 15 times in here, on dimensional ground, I'm going to have 1 over m squared to the 15. So this, on dimensional ground, is going to have more momentum than the numerator. And so for a given number of term lines, I can always make it diverge as much as I like by inserting a whole bunch of these interactions like 1 over m squared to them. And so that means that it's always going to be true that I can find interactions that were not already in my Lagrangian which are going to diverge, and I can't then absorb the counterterms and things that I had by the time. I'm going to have to start adding more and more complicated terms in my Lagrangian. Whereas in the QED, that never happens because you're never you can never profit by sticking more interactions in. It's never on dimensional grounds giving something more divergent.
So once you have this normalized diagram, if you want to copy some cross section, you will follow the same noise copy the odd loops.
But with these new interactors as well, so that you at three loops, I mean, you might have to do a supposing you're doing a photon-photon scattering or something. And supposing you're doing a tree loop, so you have a photon here and maybe something like that. But you have to also then include a graph that was nominally at a lower number of loops, but where you have a counter-jump there. So it's, you have to include two loop graphs with these counter-jump loops as well, because the counter-jumps are like an extra loop for three. And then if you're doing it three loops, you have to actually, these counter-jumps will, they come with this. You'll have to calculate, each counter-term will actually have a series itself inside of it. Because order by order, you're going to impose the normalization condition that you had, the canonical normalization of regular plane. And so that means that this graph, the alpha term here in this two-loop graph is giving you a three-loop result, but the alpha squared term in here is giving you a four-loop result. So if you're working in four loops, you get this graph that count both as a three-loop and a four-loop graph. When you took the alpha and the alpha squared term as a counter-term. So it kind of makes it more cumbersome, but in principle, it's the same as before. You just have more interactions to keep track of that you weren't following before.
So if you copy the tree, that will result to be some infinitesimal or be divergent or series of some.
At tree level, there's no integrals. The number of integrals you're doing is always the number of loops.
So if you use a new Feynman integrals, use the division of these three.
Yeah.
And then you copy the tree level. So,
yeah, there's sort of the same. But at tree level, these things will all be zero. Because at tree level, what happens is that the powers of alpha are being counted by powers of loop, by loops. So the leading loop expansion is always tree level. And in tree level graphs, there are no loops, so there's no integrals, so no divergences arise. And so for the tree graphs, these things don't arise because they're putting them into a tree graph makes them self-dominant because there's an exit.
This requires. Really depends on how many loops there are. And these rules will be different if you come to different order of loops. These rules will be rules for
this. Yeah. So to be completely concrete, if you're doing the thing we started out with, and that would be the tree graph, if you're scattering electrons from V1s, then we were looking at one of the graphs was this, but then we also have to do the counterterm one. And you have to worry about the other graphs we could be doing. With a counterterm in it. So a tree graph with a counterterm insertion is competing with a loop graph with all counterterms. And if we went to two loops, then we write down the two loop graphs with no counterterms, we write down one loop graphs with counterterms, and tree loop graphs with counterterms. And then, so the counterterms are always in the lower loop graphs, because they contain extra factors of alpha themselves.
So, last question. This Z1, Z3, are they?
Depends how you count. So if the cutoff is, so if you actually, supposing if you put in a cutoff and you calculate these things to be 1 plus alpha over 4 pi logarithm cutoff squared by the electron mass squared, which is something number, or something, 3 or something, you know, something. And so if you took the cutoff to infinity, right? And I think it's actually minus. So it's but if the cutoff is less than the Planck mass, pretty much this logarithm is 20 or something. So then the alpha wins, and so this thing becomes less than 1, and then z is really between 0 and 1, like you would expect. With physically, this is a another way of saying this is that we calculated the state, the electron state or the photon state, the given momentum. That was like I said, the free Hamiltonian. But imagine now we calculated the eigenstate of the full Hamiltonian in perturbation theory, that was the energy eigenstate corresponding to the photon of a given momentum. It's going to be this plus sum of Rawlson other states with some coefficients. And so this is now some new, this is now the photon state to a better accuracy than the unperturbed limit. And what we're calculating with z is the overlap between this state and this state. So it should always be less than 1. Because you're looking at it at an angle, essentially, in the open space. And it is. If the cutoff is some finite thing, if the coupling is sufficiently small, which has to be for perturbation theory, the missing is always sinuses, it's less than one. So it really physically is a that's the reason why the residue of the pole is not one is that you're in it, when you insert a complete set of states, you're using the wrong states. And so you have to really keep track of the fact that the overlap between this state and this state is not exactly one. Because there's some, you know, this state is really not parallel to the one you start off with, you diagonalize the full Hamiltonian. And so this thing really should be a non-zero number between 0 and 1, and it is as long as you don't take a cutoff infinity. But until, you know, 20 years ago, people always took a cutoff infinity, and that always made things look bizarre. So you just never take a cutoff infinity. Think of it as being, you know, 30 TeV or something, you know, infinity there. So I'm coming back to you guys, so don't let the printer go.